Let's see. We've got a lot of keyboards to talk about this week. We've got some hardware releases and some software updates. So let's jump in with the keyboard stuff. So Mayo, I have the Magic Keyboard for the iPad Pro 11 inch. And I've had it for about half a day. So I can't say a whole lot about the durability and long-term experience with it, but I can give you my initial impressions at least. So
go for it.
Okay. So I'm using it with the 11 inch iPad Pro, not the 12.9 inch, which I imagine would be an even better experience if you don't count weight, because it's a fuller size than this. You know how Apple does like a standard keyboard size on all of the MacBooks? And then when you've got like a 16 inch, you've got just bigger speaker grills on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this keyboard is smaller than that standard size of a MacBook keyboard using the 11 inch. And a lot of ways I'm thinking about this is like comparing it to when I had the 12 inch MacBook, because it's in that kind of weight class and everything. So it's, a little bit tighter than that. But I my expectations for this was like, it's going to be a really good stand. It's going to be a better keyboard than the Smart Keyboard has been. Plus there's the trackpad stuff, and it meets all those expectations in terms of how ergonomic it is and easy to take in and out and use it in tablet mode. And a lot of the keyboard accessories, even like the Smart Keyboard Folio, which is like front and back coverage, feels like it encourages you to use your iPad that way all the time. Whereas this is just like, like Johnny Ive sense, as true to its form as it can be, because as we know, you put the iPad on and off and it sticks magnetically. It doesn't feel like you're using your iPad like in some kind of a compartment,
In many ways, it almost could be called like the Magic Keyboard stand, almost, because there's a lot of like just the way it is and how, it is pretty hefty and you don't have the fold back option that you get on the Smart Keyboard Folio, mm-hmm. but it's like perfect for like a desk environment where you can, if you're using your iPad in like an office in your house and you just leave it on the stand, then you go into the lounge to like relax wherever, you just pull the iPad with you and leave the case where it is.
Yeah, I've been very impressed with like the viewing angles and everything too, just when using it as a stand, like you mentioned. Some points of like just irritation or I guess like growing pains with using it for the first is when it's closed, the keyboard layer is definitely thicker than like the back cover layer, but when it's closed, it's like visually so close that to me, I get confused about which way to open it, and it's stiff and it's, it closes and it's like really closed and you gotta kind of pry it apart. So,
it only has the logo, the Apple logo on one side of it though, right?
Yeah, but it's super faint.
Cause it's not like, printed or anything. They've just like done a really small like embossing or debossing of it in the middle.
Yeah.
So I guess if you catch the light wrong, you probably don't even see it.
Yeah. So I guess I'm kind of like looking at it this way, and maybe it's that I should look for the camera. But I found myself looking at it kind of like center top or center side. I'm like, which way do I pry? Because either way, it feels the same, whether you're prying the magnet off the backside or the keyboard off the front side, to open it. So,
And you definitely can't open it with one finger. Like you need to like, you said prize it open. That's probably a good description. Like,
yeah.
It's not like a laptop where the top will just come off, basically effortlessly. There is a bit of, separation.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a challenge to, you could do it and wrangle it, but it's like, it's not the most natural way to do it. Cause but I'm having to remember the volume buttons top left and the, the little power button too in that corner. So button top left corner. And that's helping me kind of learn which side to pry open, because you can look for the camera, you can try to figure out the thickness difference, but it's really close. Just when you're kind of glancing at it. The backlit nature of the keyboard, just being a backlit keyboard, just having never had that on an iPad, I've not used any of the third-party accessories that bring that to the iPad, is neat. It's a really good keyboard.
Can you rank the quality of the backlighting on the scale of the laptops? Because obviously the 2016 Butterfly key lighting was very, very bad and the newer one is much better. So does it bleed? What's it like?
Well, okay, so that's another thing. It doesn't feel exactly like typing on my 16-inch MacBook Air, and even though they're both scissor switches. And I think it's because it's a tighter space, there's not space in between. And as much as the 16-inch MacBook Air is not the butterfly keyboard, but it's definitely firmer than Scissor Switch is before. You know, it's like a cross between the two. It doesn't have as much wobble as even like the 16-inch MacBook Air has, so it feels like it's stiffer than that. And then in terms of backlighting, that 12-inch MacBook was like the worst.
Yeah.
It had uneven backlighting and like symbols were half covered. The only thing is like light leakage from at an angle, you know, and you can, I think it's like not as bad as any MacBook. I think it might be their best yet, at least on the 11-inch version, because like something I see a lot is like the space bar will have a light on either side, mm-hmm. but not across the center. And this is like segmented into several pieces, but at least it's across the bottom. So, and then the keycaps themselves are like evenly lit because they're so small. It'd be hard not to, I think.
Yeah, because like on the 11-inch keyboard, like the control key is shrunk down, so it doesn't even have the word like control or command written out fully, right? It says it's like abbreviated.
Well, control and option are, but command is CMD. Yeah.
Okay, so command is CMD, but options written out. Okay.
Yeah. And then
because command's like the worst offender in terms of backlighting on my 15-inch MacBook Pro from 2016, because the left half of it is fully lit, and then the right half, like the A and D letters, start tailing off. So I'd be interested if someone has the 12.9-inch one to say what the, you know, what the actual backlighting situation is like on that key, whether it's better like the 16-inch MacBook Pro or whether it's, you know, like the older designs.
Yeah, to me the worst offender is on command, but it's the this if you're on the left command key, it's the top right loop, or on the right one is the top left loop, one closer to the trackpad on top.
And yeah, that off, mine has that as well.
Yeah, it's like very dim on the 11-inch iPad keyboard. It's so small that it would be hard to not be backlit evenly because of how small it is. But yeah, the backlighting is really cool. Get, you know, not having to deal with Bluetooth. This is just a smart connector benefit, but it's the first time I've used a smart connector keyboard with backlighting, and it's neat. And you're like, you know, I think we've talked about that before, like how would you pull it off with battery and everything? And because it's not Bluetooth, because it's sharing the battery with the iPad, then it's just like lighting up a screen, but it's even easier. So
yeah, because lighting one LED on those things is not power intensive when you're comparing it to the internal battery of the iPad, which is, you know, powering a 11-inch or larger display constantly. Like, you know, a few lights across the keyboard is very power cheap. That's why LEDs are so good.
Yeah. The charging situation, it reminds me of going from the 12-inch MacBook to a USB-C MacBook with ports on either side, because you can charge from the left or the right if you're just charging the iPad. Because you've got the charging port from the iPad on the right side, and then on the left side, you've got that pass-through USB-C port for charging. So that means for the first time, you know, you can choose which side to charge on. So if you're using it in bed or in a chair or something like that, then you can charge from either side, which is a benefit that you got once you left MagSafe on the Macs, but you had to have a port on both sides. And so the 12-inch didn't have that, but then the other one's dead. So that's something, it's just a small thing. Using it as like a passive browser, like, you know, you're just like reading the web or, you know, following Twitter on your iPad, like, you know, when you're lounging, it's really good for that. And it's like the screen, it's because in those situations, you're just kind of scrolling around and you're not interacting very much. You're just like, mm-hmm. you know, moving the page around. And it's like something about just like flick it and with a trackpad and let it go, you know, and just your hand isn't in the way whenever you're browsing. So it's really good for like this passive browsing without even using the keyboard part. And that's not just because you're using the cursor, but because you're using, you've got the screen will stay up in different angles, you know, so, and the magnets are strong. So it stays up, you know, if you're like upside down, it keeps its shape.
Could you use it on your lap without worrying about it like flipping, flopping over?
Yeah, 100%. I've used it on the desk, on my lap, like in a lounge chair, kind of upside down, you know, like really, like, you know, where this thing is kind of defying gravity, but it's because the magnet, it keeps that shape. At no point in using it have I felt like this is attached with a magnet. It's like putting it on something, you know, where it's like one structure. So, and you wouldn't do that with the smart keyboard. Like the smart keyboard is floppy, you know. So,
viewing it like degrees of tilt, what is it, restrictive, okay, what do you think?
It's funny. So I'm curious to see, like, to watch like video of this on the 12.9 inch, because I'm wondering if it's any different. But on the 11 inch, to do like a 90 degree angle and make like an L shape with it, you're barely in like the kind of the floating state where it's, you know, sitting atop the iPad without touching the bottom. It's mm-hmm. really close. There's just like a few degrees off of the back cover. And that's like the least you'd want to do is that 90 degree angle. You can,
yeah, like if you go much more than that, then it doesn't really work, right?
Right.
Like it's kind of,
if then you can go back, and you can't go as far back as like I guess I would like, maybe about 15 degrees shy of what I'd want to do. So you've kind of, and it's a pretty short range, it feels like, of like what's all the way back and then what's all the way forward that's usable.
Yeah, from what I saw on like reviews and stuff, the 90 degree angle and then the furthest back angle is basically reflecting what the smart keyboard folio gives you.
Yeah.
Because it only has two slots, right? But obviously on the Magic Keyboard, you can get the variation between those places.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not like losing out on tilt, but you're not actually gaining anymore either.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Because there's some degrees of it where like you'd be going forward and it just attaches magnetically. And kind of importantly, that when you just open it, and the back of it is staying straight up, it's not at a 90 degree angle. It's just shy of that. And so like, you're not even all the way open yet. You always kind of want to push it back a little bit to be in a comfortable position. Cause you know, it's like, you wouldn't use your laptop like half closed. You can't even like get close to that on this.
Yeah. And unless you're in like a train, on a train seat or in like a plane seat or something where sometimes you do actually want to tilt it a little bit more, but then,
yeah.
But then in those situations for the iPad, you can just use it out of the case.
Yeah, use it as an iPad, and it's the surface of the keyboard.
Yeah, pretty much. Like you don't have the limitations there.
Yeah,
which kind of makes up for the difference.
Yep. The gesture stuff. So the trackpad, I found when I was first using it, like just because the keyboard is so different from the Smart Keyboard, it's very close to using a MacBook keyboard. I was just using it as the sort of stand and keyboard happily, and then I was like, oh yeah, there's a trackpad on this, and it's so small that it's like that's part of the reason. But also, it's just new in iOS, and it's really good. I mean, it's small, but it doesn't feel like how looking back at a 15 inch MacBook Pro, that trackpad feels comically small because it's proportional. It seems like, because it's like, it is small, like physically small.
It's got to be about that old, like the old, like before the first touch trackpads made them really big. The yeah. older trackpads.
Right.
It's got to be about the same size of that, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, this 11 yeah. might be smaller, but it's the fact that it's like the ratio of trackpad to keyboard, mm-hmm. how they used to be one size as well, or about one size. And now they're just like, whatever the bottom of the case cover is not keyboard becomes trackpad, at least in height, not width. And that's the case here, is it's still wide. It's just not very, very tall. But
you can click anywhere on it, right?
You can click anywhere on it, which is important, because if you couldn't for this one on the Magic Keyboard case, the 11-inch version, it's again, it's not very tall. So
yeah, so you don't have much area to actually play with. That's a problem with the Logitech one, is that it doesn't have the again, it's physical clicking, but it doesn't have the click anywhere. It's like the classic diving board where, and the top, you know, like third, 40% of it, you just can't click at all. And so you've got a pretty small trackpad, and then another half of it is basically you can't use. For yeah. actually clicking on,
you gotta. If I were using the Logitech one, which I'll talk about more in a moment as well, because I've got one here now too, I would just go all in on tap to click, so that you can mm-hmm. get, you know, clicks anywhere. But yeah, using the trackpad is neat. Another thing about how this doesn't feel like you're turning it into like you're putting it in like some, you know, makeshift MacBook case is that I don't feel like there's any like pushback against using touch. You know, you. In terms of positioning, I guess the physical positioning of it, everything just feels reachable. You know, it's not like even, I guess, your laptop screen where you kind of be reaching out and down and around. Based on where my hands are on the keyboard and the trackpad, with the 11 inch especially, everything's just like really close to reach with my fingers. So I like that about it. It feels like I can kind of like cover my hand in one place and reach everything. So whereas I could see something else, you know, if it's a whole case that's got, you know, it's just not this compact, then it might feel like, you know, do I really want to reach out and touch that, or is it easier to use the trackpad? It feels like touch is easier than a trackpad, unless you're doing something that's like cursor specific in this case.
There's, what do you think about like the corner, like the edge gestures to reveal the dock and stuff, and all that notification center?
You're not going to discover them on your own. I was looking at video at first of like these are the gestures and everything, and it was like there's over 50, but then I think that also included like mouse and then Magic Trackpad 2, and there's fewer on this than Magic Trackpad 2 from what I understand. So I ended up on Apple's support document for gestures on the iPad. And there were ones I didn't know about, and I was having to try them. And then I was having to decide if I like them or not. Like down, like, for example, if you go on the screen where you move the cursor down mm-hmm. really fast to the center or so, just down really fast, you can get the dock if you're in an app. So just down really fast. But if you scroll down like medium speed, you go down there and nothing happens.
Yeah, you have to keep going.
Yeah, it's not like... It's not like on the Mac where if you're in a full screen app and you just kind of like put the cursor there. So it's speed is part of the gesture, not just the number of fingers and movement. And I can't think of an example on the Mac besides just like dragging inertia or scrolling inertia of like where speed becomes a part of the gesture too. But in this case, it's very much so. Or, you know, it's going to be a very slow effect to pull.
Yeah, adjusting to the dock reveal is very strange. Or the opposite, which is getting notification center by pushing up on the top edge of it. Mm-hmm. It's like you have to push. Like you can go fast and it will like bump it. But if you're just like my more natural response was to just move the cursor up to the top of the screen and then try and push beyond it. Which kind of reminds me of you know when you're on the touch bar and you have to like if you ever want to edit the touch bar, mm-hmm. you kind of have to like bring the cursor further down.
Yeah,
and it like goes to the bottom mode. Edge. It kind of feels like that, where they're kind of like faking the cursor moving down, even though they're not. Mm-hmm. But you know, you edit the touch bar once a year, if that.
If whereas, ever,
yeah. Whereas to get to the dock and notification center is much more common, and you have to like push against this like invisible wall a lot mm-hmm. for it to come down. I noticed that on the Logitech one for real, or when I used the Magic Trackpad externally as well.
Yeah, and it's and then there's just one for I guess if you want to go home, so. Okay, yeah, so...
Home, you use three fingers, yeah.
Well, that one I got used to, but also if you just want to use one finger and you're in an app, you can go down to the dock and then go down again, and that takes you home. So it's a single finger gesture with speed and the number of flicks incorporated. So it's pretty complex and compared to like me growing up on the last 10 years of, you know, multi-finger gestures on a big trackpad.
Yeah, the metaphor, I guess, is if you imagine... the opposite of what you do with your finger. So for like the edge gestures to get to notification center, you pull down from the top, or to open the dock, you pull up from the bottom, right? Off the side of the screen. Whereas if you've got the trackpad, you're pushing against the top or pulling down against the bottom.
Yeah. Like, and because it is so short, you can't just keep scrolling down to simulate a further push up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause you run off the edge of the trackpad.
Yeah. Really quickly. Yeah. So yeah. It's yeah. Yeah. So
it's not bad, but it's definitely like takes some getting used to that. When you set up an iPad from scratch, it will do that little like four screens of videos. Like, here's how you get to the dock. Here's how you go home. And it will do the little gesture, like little mini gesture walkthrough of the home indicator stuff. When you plug in like a keyboard for the first time or an external trackpad, it should probably prompt you to say like, you know, this is how you actually navigate using the trackpad.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Because on the Mac as well, when you go into like trackpad settings, you get those cute little videos of the faceless hand that do the little actions. Yeah. But the iPad settings don't have any of that.
Yeah, I remember being, I guess, 18 years old. Yeah, and using the 2008 MacBook Pro, 2009 MacBook Pro, and just like studying those videos, like, okay, this is really cool. This wasn't available on a PC that I had, you know, and that you can't really do that here. The closest thing for me was Googling to get to the support document.
Yeah, that's not ideal. Like, we've seen them do much better onboarding in recent years, whether you're talking about like HomePod setup or even the Apple Pencil 2 second generation. Like, when you plug that in for the first time, it comes up with a little screen that tells you where you can double tap and everything. Mm-hmm. But for the Magic Keyboard, they don't do any of that, which feels like a bit of an oversight.
Not yet, at least. Maybe in 14.
Yeah, not yet. At least they might add it.
Yeah. And then it definitely feels like, I guess it's like big picture, you know, it's not my Mac. You know, for me, it's been so long, I think for both of us, like windowing where you can have, you know, a spread of different window sizes on one, you know, screen is what keeps the Mac, you know, separate from the iPad for now. And having this accessory doesn't really change that for me because it's still easy to move around and everything, but I'm still in that, you know, 2.5 app limitation. So it's just, it's no different in that regard than if I was just using the iPad on its own, or with any other keyboard accessory.
The accessory could be the best accessory in the world, but you're still hitting against software limitations of the operating system at the end of the day.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things that with cursor support, they were true before, but with cursor support, they're even more true. And it's that Control Center and Notification Center have a bad design in iPad OS 13.
Because they're full screen modal?
Yeah, because they're full screen modal. It feels as, like, whenever you were using a cursor with accessibility, it felt, you know, it's like, fine, treat the cursor like your finger, and that's what you're doing, is like you're simulating a finger on the screen, and it's an accessibility feature, not you know, the default way of using it. With this, it's an Apple official accessory, and even with the gesture to get Control Center and Notification Center to come down, the full screen version of that is not good. It feels,
yeah, like Control Center, you don't have to do the drag, you can just click the three little Wi-Fi, you know, location battery indicator in the corner, but then it reveals a full screen modal thing that covers up everything else you're doing,
right?
And it's not like using the whole screen, you don't get expanded options or, you know, multiple different buttons. It's still just the tiny little like skinny panel just shoved over to the right hand side of the screen, and the whole background's blurred, and then you still have to like right click or long press on the things to reveal the other buttons. So like, either they should use the whole screen and actually show all the buttons that are hidden behind the first, you know, behind the long press, essentially show them up front because you've got the screen real estate, mm-hmm. or they should make the Control Center like a popover or something that doesn't, you know, obscure everything else on the screen.
Yeah, I'm thinking that even if we didn't have this accessory, that having Notification Center and Control Center not be full screen would be okay anyway.
Oh, 100%.
I mean, I'm at 10 level.
Yeah. Notification Center, Control Center, Siri, all that stuff, yes, doesn't need to be full screen on the iPad.
Yeah.
It can be little like pop-up, kind of like picture-in-picture windows that they can just like sit over to the corner, especially for something like Siri where you know, you might ask it a question, it just comes up on the right, you can carry on doing what you're doing in the app, you don't have to be disturbed by this full screen presentation, and then you could just like, you know, tap it away or swipe it away when you're done with it.
Yeah. Yep. And then again...
Which is how the Mac works, by the way.
Exactly, yeah. And then again, I've had this since like last night, and so it's less than 24 hours now. Maybe about 20 hours plus sleep. But I've already kind of felt like opening it is just as stiff as ever in the last 20 hours. But adjusting the viewing angle feels easier now. And so I guess what I wonder is it breaking into how it will always be, or will it get, you know, worse over time to where it's like floppy, you know? That's yet to be seen because they haven't been out that long.
Well, one person I do want to shout out is a reader called Jonathan Reed, and I tweeted like the day of, there was someone who got a little one of those voltage meters, and they plugged it into the USB-C port on the case and then compared it to just plugging it in directly, and it was basically showing that the wattage was very, very similar. It was like 28 watts directly, 23 watts if plugged in via the pass-through port.
Yeah.
And this was a question running up to the thing coming out, because the previous like smart connector accessories that have charged have been pretty slow, like the old Logitech base, it would take forever. Mm-hmm. And the wattage at least implied that it was going to be close enough to, you know, full power charging, essentially. Yeah. And Reed actually replied, and he did like 10 minute by 10 minute checkups on the battery power, and it was basically in line. Like, it was 15 minutes slower than charging via directly through the cable, but, you know, that's close enough for what you need.
Yeah, nice. One thing with the gestures, I just kind of was playing around and reminded me of this, is the gesture to control slide over apps. You know, I mean, that's hard anyway. You pull them from off screen and move them around and everything, and you got to be in just the right place. I've not yet mastered it with the trackpad, so yeah.
And the little like nub when you open slide over and then you want to like flip between them, so you got to go to that little nub at the bottom. Lining that up with your cursor is surprisingly hard. Like, you overshoot it or whatever. Whereas on a finger, that's actually a lot easier. It's almost like you have to be less precise when you're using the finger for certain things like that. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes the automatic like morphing of the cursor gets in the way when you don't need it. But I like the morphing of the cursor in general. But there's definitely some little spots where you're bumping into the realities of this was designed for fingers, not for little like cursors to be in the places. We are sponsored this week by Pillow. Getting a good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life-changing. and Pillow might just be what you need. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. Just download the app on your Apple Watch, and tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of the Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. You can compare your sleep quality with your weight, steps, caffeine consumption, so many different health metrics to discover how they might be affecting how you sleep. You can enable recording, and Pillow will save the sounds and noises that you make during sleep. That's things like sleep talking, sleep apnea, snoring, or just random unexpected noises in the garden that might be affecting your sleep. And a lot of users have been surprised by the results. Pillow is very privacy-minded. All of your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device. And when it syncs to iCloud, it's using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts. You don't have to sign up. Everything's anonymous. And it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being. And if you're working from home, like many of us are at the moment, you can take naps using Pillow's power nap modes. And for alarms, Pillow can even wake you up on your iPhone, Apple Watch, or iPad. And on WatchOS 6, it's using the latest extended runtime APIs to minimize battery consumption on the Apple Watch. Pillow is available in the App Store for iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. That's naybox.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for their support of Happy Hour.
Yeah, a few more things there is on the Mac, and I mentioned last week that part of this analysis would be how does it compare to the Mac, and so what's muscle memory got to do, and I think I'll be okay where I can learn what the iPad does versus what the Mac does, just like you do without a keyboard and trackpad, you figure out all the gestures, that'll be okay. There's some things though that I think would be good to come from the Mac. Like one thing is hot corners on the Mac. Is something that's not, they don't really promote it, but it's been buried in at least the screensaver settings and then one more place in system preferences where you can assign an action to a corner. Like I use top right to show my notifications, bottom right for the desktop. Those things, they get pretty close with the gesture, like mouse up and then like quickly push back up again to get to control center, notification center. They're just full screen, not modal. but it would be nice in the future to have hot corners.
Customization.
Yeah. Even if it's accessibility. And then speaking of accessibility, there's a setting on the Mac that I use that was a default for a version or so. And then it became hidden in accessibility. And that's the 3-finger drag mm-hmm. Gesture. So when it was default in the Mac, I think it was like, it wasn't default, but you could turn it on, just like tap to
click. It was in the trackpad settings, yeah. Like it's the main trackpad settings.
It's like tap to click. It's not on by default, but you can turn it on, and then it's there. So in this case, you turn on 3-finger dragging, and you take 3 fingers on the trackpad, you put the cursor over something, and you can move it around without clicking at all. And I always turn it on a new Mac, even though it's not in the system preferences anymore. It's in accessibility. There's no version of that on the iPad. It's 3 fingers is what you do to get, move your windows out of the way and go home or get to.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem with both hot corners and 3-finger drag is that, like on the Mac, they kind of deprioritized hot corners when the multi-touch trackpads became more popular because people started you used to get it to expose by assigning it to a hot corner.
Yeah.
Well, in the modern world, now you just do a 3-finger gesture on the trackpad to reveal it. Mm-hmm. And those just like swipe ups don't interfere with the dragging as much because you have to like precisely go over the element first before you like double click and drag around.
Yeah.
Whereas on the iPad, those 3-finger drags are like critical parts of navigation, like swiping left and right between apps with 3 fingers or going home or all of that stuff. It's like the Mac just has that extra like leeway to have. And like the tertiary gestures not be super required, so you can have the optional features tacked on the end. Yeah. Whereas on the iPad situation at the moment, that's just not feasible. Like they need the 3-finger gestures to do the navigation because otherwise you'd be super annoyed. So yeah. it's like a hard situation. They're in a corner, kind of how when you don't have the trackpad at all, they're in a corner with the fact that they're now using edge gestures on every you know, on every horizontal and vertical side. So they run out, and now, and every time they bring a new feature, now it's like, you know, where exactly they're going to put this that isn't like stupid? And you know, they're obviously banging up against the wall there and still figuring that stuff out.
Yep. So I think what I'll do for muscle memory purposes is like when I want to three finger drag something, and like an example of this is if I've got two apps side by side and I want to move the, you know, where the center of that is and click on the little thing.
The divider. Yeah.
Yeah. I really don't want to click on it. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, it's like, that feels like not smooth.
Yeah. I had that exact same experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think if every time my brain says three finger drag, which isn't a thing on this, I think what I'll try to do is touch, you know, touch and drag instead. Cause it seems like that's smoother than clicking maybe for in this case, cause it feels just kind of clunky to click and move that thing around.
Well, because when the trackpad's small, you're clicking with like your thumb and then you're carving off another section of the trackpad for your other finger to move the actual thing around with a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it just, you're just using even more space on the trackpad, which makes it feel pretty awkward because your fingers are like close to each other. And this is something where if you're using the iPad with the Magic Keyboard, like as your primary computer, you'd get used to it, right? But the switching between, look, we're not going to abandon our laptops, right? We're just not going to do it at the current, in the current environment of the software situation. There's no way that me or you can stop using macOS on a laptop, right? Mm-hmm. And your brain's always going to be stuck in that conflict of, oh, I'm used to having essentially an excessively large trackpad on the MacBook, and then you come to the iPad and it's like those same things are always going to feel wrong. Whereas if you were in a you know, one of the cases where you could be like exclusively iPad usage as your primary machine, you would just like acclimatize those things and it wouldn't like pop up in your head. It's the switching between thing that I think is the real problem.
Yeah, that makes sense. I agree with that. Like two more things here. One is that I feel like the multitasking animation when you're on the home screen and you swipe up and you see multitasking. For one, it's kind of tricky to do this sometimes. Like if I was on a video right now, I'd be failing at showing you this. But the way that they animate, it feels like it takes too long for what it is. Whereas with touch, it's kind of like mapped to your finger. But with a gesture, there's like move and then wait.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of like watch it play out, and it also feels like it's just kind of like flying all over the place. So that's where just like touch versus cursor can be a conflict for me, and it's so minor that, you know, I love this thing. You really can't say so much about what you like, and you know, because like you don't need to like love a keyboard or a trackpad, like, you just need to like it, you know, it works or it doesn't work. So this thing works just like I wanted to. And it's half the weight of my MacBook Pro 16-inch. When I put it over the MacBook Pro, like the MacBook closed, it was about half of the like physical dimensions too. Like, so it's literally like half the size of my MacBook. And so it's good in those kind of ultra portable situations. And then after work, like I'm not looking at the MacBook anymore. I'm, you know, lounging out with the iPad and using it.
Yeah, I think if you had the 12.9 with the Magic Keyboard case, the weight starts becoming a bit more of a factor.
Yes.
Because it's like 1300 grams, which is heavier than a MacBook Air and closing on a 13-inch MacBook Pro weight. So it's like, at that point, you've got a pretty hefty, you know, block on to carry around with.
Right, yeah. So for the 11-inch, I'm really pleased with it. I did let my wife, Kelsey, try it out. I was like, hey, try this. This is a new thing. And she knew what it was. And she was like, I want one. So it's immediately.
Did you tell her how much it was?
No, I didn't tell her. She was using the Bridge keyboard to make her iPad like, you know, like her MacBook that she had and gave up, you know. And she's plenty happy with it. She was like, well, this is a cursor. This is better. Like, you know, okay, cool.
As long as I think the design of it is pretty awesome. And all of the stand stuff and the case stuff and the fact that it doesn't topple when you pull it on and you can put it back on the magnets, single-handed is like awesome. It's just such a shame that it's so expensive that realistically most people going in to buy iPads in the Apple store, they're going to buy the Smart Keyboard Folio just because the price is so much lower. I think this product is awesome, kind of like the HomePod situation. It's really cool, but it's also almost like priced out of the market almost. I think it's just so it's so expensive. Like,
Yeah, I'm trying not to think about that.
Yeah, if you buy two keyboards, which you're about to do, that's $600 just in keyboard cases.
Yeah, I don't like those sentences.
And if the iPad changes dimensions again next year, you're going to have to think about, you're going to spend another $300 on a new keyboard case that fits that one. Like, it definitely helped them that the chassis didn't change from the 2018 and the 2020, because people that just had the 2018 iPads couldn't get the keyboard or not feel so bad because they haven't had to pay the massive upgrade fee and just pay the keyboard price. But I hope somehow, someday, they can bring the price down on these things, because more people should definitely have them and use them, but they're just not going to when, you know, it's $300 or $350 if you're the top winner.
Or if they don't bring the price down, then these will hold their resale value. And you can, like, sell yours for half off and then get half off the new one if you change prices. But, so we've got one, a tip for purchasing these. So I think they're really hard to get through Apple already. I was looking at Best Buy, and they had, at the beginning of this week, including midweek, you could get Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Friday, Saturday, Monday delivery, depending if you pay like $10 or free. And Apple's was like, you know, mid-May, late May. So it seems like Best Buy got their round of inventory, and then they sell out of whatever they have, and then it'll be backdated there too. But so you can't walk in and buy them anywhere, but they're not that hard to get a hold of. You've spent more time with the Logitech keyboard. How's that been?
Last week I was very effusive about it, and I still am, but I have an annoying problem, and it kind of ruins it. Like, maybe a normal person, like not like in the tech sphere, wouldn't even notice, but for me it's just like like I kind of half given up on it. And the problem is, I'd say about 1 in 8 times that you're two-finger scrolling, and Jeff notices as well with his unit, he's got a video, sometimes it doesn't do what you're doing. Like, you'll feel like, I kept thinking that I'd run my fingers off the bottom of the trackpad, because obviously, like the Magic Keyboard, the Logitech Combo Touch trackpad as well is pretty small. So I what would happen is the cursor would move rather than the page scroll. And I kept thinking I was like accidentally running off the edge of the trackpad area, being used to the laptop, but then I literally look down and I'm dead center of this trackpad, two finger scrolling, and you know, about 1 in 8, 1 in 10 times it just moves the cursor instead of scrolling, and it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it messes you up so much. I'm like, ooh, flicking, oh no, that's wrong. And it's a shame, because otherwise I think it's a really, really nice product, and I've asked Logitech about it. They're supposedly getting back to me. Some other people have got it and said they haven't had an issue. I even fake connected it to my 12.9 inch iPad Pro, which is from 2015, so obviously it's not compatible, but I just like propped it up and held it in place, and on that one it didn't happen. So it was a bit confusing, because I was testing it with the brand new 10.2 inch iPad, and it was definitely happening there, and I was unplugging it, replugging it, restarting the iPad, trying everything, and it still happens even today. But then I like jammed the iPad, the 12.9 inch iPad, at an angle on top of the magnetic bit of the smart connector, because luckily the smart connector is the same, and on that iPad I could not get it to do it. So I don't know if it's a problem with the Logitech keyboard itself, or like an iOS issue, or maybe the connection on the bottom of the iPad is a bit off and it just misses some input sometimes, but it's kind of soured my enthusiasm for it.
That's too bad. You shared that with me. I saw Jeff's coverage as well. I took a shot at it and ordered one for my daughter's iPad. I don't know if I mentioned it on here, but her iPad's, she's got a crack in it, so I wasn't sure if I really wanted to invest in this one. But then she put tape on it, like physically, like packaging tape over the crack, and she's like, "It's fine now." So I took that off, and I put a screen protector over the crack and the whole thing. So if she's okay with tape, then the screen protector is totally okay with her. And this thing arrived right before we started recording, and for what it is, it's half the price of the thing for the Pro, without the case or without the keyboard attached. Like, just the case part of it itself with the kickstand mechanisms, like, she'll be happy with that.
An 8-year-old, 10-year-old kid probably won't even notice the problem I'm describing. It would show up if you're like, an adult or even a teenager trying to do like, write a long document or whatever, and you're scrolling back up, and then the cursor just flings off in the wrong direction, which you didn't mean to.
Yeah. And she's wanted a Chromebook for some reason, as long as she's had iPads with keyboards. And maybe it's the mouse part of it, but I'm hoping that this satisfies her. Like, This is your laptop here. It's kind of neat. Like the keyboard part has kind of a wedge shape to it where it gets taller in the back. You know, you can take it off and just use the iPad with the kickstand. And I think that you'll enjoy that part about it. And then there are function keys. So you don't have those on the other one, but you know, on the Magic Keyboard, but you've got them on the Logitech one. It's the little cloth design and everything. Like, you know, I hope she likes this. I think she might use this more than the Smart Keyboard. And, you know, so we'll see how that goes.
This week, Happy Hour is sponsored by Intego. We've partnered with the company to offer 9to5 Mac readers and Happy Hour listeners an exclusive 50% off the company's Intego Mac Internet Security X9 bundle. Now, Intego has been keeping Mac safe since 1997 and are one of the leaders in Mac security software. The Intego X9 bundle features two crucial tools that help to keep your Mac safe, secure, and protected from internet threats. One of these apps is Virus Barrier, the world's number one antivirus app for Mac. If you go to the show notes, you can see a comparison chart, and Intego ranked top in effectiveness with 100% Mac malware detection in the AV tests. And it blocks all kinds of adware, spyware, and malware from infecting your machine. And then the other app in this bundle is NetBarrier. And NetBarrier acts as a two-way firewall. It can prevent incoming attacks on your network, like a normal firewall, but it also alerts you when apps on your Mac are trying to phone home and contact third-party endpoints that you wouldn't expect them to. This lets you monitor your apps, know they're only communicating with domains and services that make sense. And if you see something pop up that is untoward and unexpected, you can block the data from ever leaving your machine. Protect your Mac from viruses and keep tabs on apps that could potentially violate your privacy with the Intego Mac Security Bundle. Head to the link in the show notes to get 9to5 Mac's Deal of the Month. That's 50% off your first year of Virus Barrier and Net Barrier. Thanks again to Intego for sponsoring the show.
All right, Mayo, some big service news this week. Apple Services is in workplaces. This was the news. It was like the most boring newsroom headline I've seen. But, you know, if you're in one of the countries where you didn't have the App Store, this is huge. This is like, man.
Surely in those countries where the App Store wasn't officially supported in your region, they must have been doing like, you know, faking your country to your account to a different country to like have an App Store. Like, how can you have an iPhone in the modern world and not download any apps on it at all?
Like people do that to get a US account, for example, or a Japanese account, for example. So you're probably right about that. But now,
yeah, and I think loads of people switch regions more than you'd expect. Like on my TweetDeck column, which covers Apple TV Plus stuff, there's loads of people complaining that it won't let them switch their region back because they've started the free trial. Oh. And so whenever you do a subscription, you can't switch regions unless you cancel your subscription on it. So that applies to Apple TV or anything, right? So any in-app purchase subscription. And I see that complaint come up constantly. I'm like, damn, there's a lot of people in the world pretending to be from another country just to access, you know, X App Store feature or whatever. Or in this case, the App Store, full stop. And like, I guess if Apple's finally expanding it to these countries, it reduces the demand for people to do that. But it's still kind of crazy that you could like officially buy an iPhone in, you know, 20 countries last week that wouldn't even come with an App Store that now do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What all services are covered? Is it App Store and what else?
They said expansion for App Store, Apple Arcade, Apple Podcasts app, and iCloud, apparently. That's in 20 countries. And then Apple Music got an additional 72 countries. I'm surprised iCloud was limited. There's no content deals to arrange there, so I'm not really sure why Apple can't have iCloud everywhere de facto. Unless there's some random legal regulatory stuff there to sort out.
Yeah.
But I guess it's there now in 20 new countries. I did, after I posted this story, a lot of people told me that the Apple Music is technically available there, but the size of the library is pretty small. So for whatever reason, the labels haven't agreed proper terms a lot there, and a lot of like high profile music just wasn't available through the service. So technically you could subscribe to Apple Music, but you're not getting like the US music collection. Although I also think the price is lower. They do this in India, like Spotify, Apple Music, all of them. The Indian subscription price is the equivalent of under $1, basically. And I think a lot of that's just to do with the fact that the labels charge different rates for that country, and because it's an emerging market, they're trying to get people on board, so the rate's a lot lower. But also, the actual like library you can access is way different than what you get, like what we'd be used to, right? They're just the amount of music total is just way different in those countries. So the like you pay less, but you're also getting less, if you know what I mean. So it's not quite the stellar 60 million songs experience that you get in, you know, the Europe or the US.
Yeah, there's a lot of the 60 million songs I've never heard of that I probably don't care about. And then Apple.
Unfortunately, I think the like countries like someone was applying for me, Georgia, and they probably tout 40 million songs, but the 5 million that are missing are the ones you actually want to listen to, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And then Apple Music comes to Samsung smart TVs. This is the first time that the music app has come somewhere on a TV that isn't tvOS on the Apple TV, right?
Yeah, this is kind of out of left field. Obviously, last year, about this time, they released the TV app for Samsung TVs with it promised to come to other brands later in the year. I presume the same arrangement will happen here where Samsung got an exclusivity period. The Samsung press release even says, "We are proud to be the first manufacturer to offer the Apple Music app on our smart TVs." So I expect this to come to other brands down the road. Like, the thing with like Apple Music or Spotify or any of these streaming music services is they're really quite similar in their offerings at the end of the day, right? Like, you get the same library. For a couple of years, there was that big deal about exclusives where you'd have some artists signing exclusive deals to only be on one service or the other. But then the labels kind of kicked against that and pushed back. And so that hasn't really happened in the same way. You get some differentiation in kind of like the playlists and the mixes and the algorithmic stuff. And then obviously Apple has its like Beats One radio shows. But in general, the core of the service is identical, and it comes down to like brass tacks: does this work on all my devices? As a decider, are you going to pay $9.99 to Spotify? Or are you going to pay $9.99 to Apple Music? Mm-hmm. And I think getting it onto TVs is a pretty big deal for the service, because like if you come to the end of your Apple Music trial and you're getting to the point where you have to choose to pay for it or not, and you don't have an Apple TV, which, you know, reality check, most people don't. If your Samsung TV or your smart TV has a Spotify app just sitting there, it's just going to probably make more sense if you subscribe to that instead. Like, it's not any real indictment against the quality of the service. It's just, you know, device compatibility.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we've seen it happen with Amazon Echo, like the smart speaker stuff. Clearly, the smart speakers are more important than smart TVs because smart speakers are oriented around music. And you see it in the priority, right? Last year, they were expanding to all these smart speakers while the smart TVs were getting the TV app for video. And now they're going around and, you know, dotting off the I's and crossing the T's to bring the music app to smart TVs as well.
Yeah, and I think it's some people wondering, like, what does it matter who wants to play music through a TV?
Loads of people.
Yeah, loads of people. And like one half of it is that Apple's got a big music library collection. So like over the weekend, I was doing some work around the house, and I just pulled up an artist and I played all their music videos, and then that was coming through my TV, which is connected to a nice sound system. And so that's why a lot of people.
Yeah, and they have really nice curated music video playlists on Apple Music as well, which is a nice touch.
Yeah, a lot of TVs are plugged up to their home theater system, and so it might be the best speaker in your house is coming through your TV. So, you know, you can do AirPlay or lots of other things in different scenarios, but in this case.
I wonder if you get lyrics on the Samsung app.
No,
like the modern lyrics experience.
I think I'll get the app on one of my TVs. I'll check it out and see.
Yeah, basically all the TVs that get the TV app are getting the music app as well eventually. So
yeah, nice.
Like if they had an Apple TV hardware stick that was super accessible and super cheap, the need for stuff like this to support all these random TV operating systems would be way lower. But they don't, so they're kind of their hands kind of forced there, I think, ultimately. Like, and they probably did it last year with the TV app and saw pretty high adoption, and they were like, okay, we need to do this for music as well, and down the road probably podcasts and everything else. Wherever they've got content services, I think you're going to see them go pretty universally cross-platform. The only big outlier at the moment is like the TV app isn't available for like Android phones or tablets. And so if you want to watch TV Plus, but you're an Android user, you're kind of out of luck. You have to deal with the website, which is even worse than the native app, which is not great to begin with. So that's hopefully something where they, you know, get that in place eventually. Like, it doesn't really make sense for them to make that kind of stuff exclusive. Even something like iCloud Photos, I can see why they don't want to go to the extent of supporting, you know, an iCloud Photos app on every TV and keeping that like only within the iOS ecosystem and on Apple TV. But for their just like music streaming, video streaming, I don't think they really have an argument not to do that everywhere.
Mm, yeah. They do have photos for Windows, right? Like, because they're the control.
They do have photos for Windows.
Yeah. And we also saw Apple Music leave beta on the web. So I think what that literally means is that certain browsers couldn't access it and it had a beta tag on it and now it doesn't. So
yeah, so it used to be available at beta.music.apple.com and now it's music.apple.com. They have added, you know, a few little features and stuff over the 8 months or whatever it was in beta, but it's mostly the same experience as what we tried on day one.
Yep.
And they've changed it so that if you the search result pages now for music take you to the music app, which is a much more direct way if you're coming from, like, if you Google for an artist and you see the Apple Music listing. Previously, it would take you to this kind of, like, what used to be called iTunes Preview, this weird just page which would just list the album information. You can kind of get, like, half preview it there. And then over time, they started adding, like, login with Apple Music, and you can listen to the whole thing right on this page. But it still wasn't, like, the Apple Music client. And so now Apple Music for Web is out of beta. When you go through the search results, you end up inside Apple Music Player, so it's much more direct to, you know, play or, in Apple's mind, sign up if you don't already. So there's a lot of discovery and exposure they can get for their subscription by doing that and having that available.
Yeah, and in the beta version of iOS right now, I think sharing music to Instagram stories, beta 1 added that, and then beta 2 made it possible to make it an active link, I believe.
Yeah, so it probably links to that website.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if you're not on iOS, I guess.
And again, a web player was another big reason that people would pick Spotify over Apple Music. So between smart TV support and web support, they're definitely checking off the boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think we've seen quite a lot of investment in Apple Music actually in the last like 2 years, which lines up with Oliver Schusser, I think his name is, like, taking charge. So yeah. I don't think that's actually made a difference. Like, they've done a lot if you actually look back and see, between, you know, acquiring Shazam and getting all the lyric stuff integrated, expanding to Amazon Echo, expanding to smart TVs, doing the web player, and as in addition to a lot more local content, they have playlists now for like loads of different regions and stuff that are like dedicated to just those regions, versus the worldwide stuff. And then they started doing Apple Music Replay, which is still currently only available through the website, but hopefully with iOS 14 they'll integrate into the app natively too. But yeah, I think overall Apple Music, they've been investing in it pretty heavily, and it does seem to line up with the executive like leadership change. Mm-hmm. So I guess he's doing a good job.
Yeah, it's nice to see a service ran like, you know, sort of as productive as this, as if it were a competitive company all on its own, and not mm-hmm. you know, it could just be stagnant inside of Apple and still do fine.
Yeah, because that is Apple's biggest problem, or like Achilles' heel, really, is that they don't need, quote unquote, need any of these things to be like they you know, it's like the quote about Steve Jobs, always be hungry, right? Like their secondary services are only secondary because the iPhone and their hardware business is so massive, but ultimately their growth depends on a lot of these content services, but the weaknesses in the content services can be masked over by the hardware sales almost, so you don't quite get the same competitive aggression that you would if they were just like startups on their own. So you can be well-funded being part of Apple, but you also don't quite have the fire under your belly to actually innovate all the time. And I think with the Apple Music switch up, we've seen them definitely get more on you know, new features, new rollouts, new stuff every month almost in terms of like content releases. Mm-hmm. And fingers crossed they'll do the same thing for TV Plus and the TV app as well. But that's we've only really been in the first like 9 months of that, so we haven't quite seen the developments there, yeah.
Yep. All right, let's talk about some Mac stuff. Mayo, this one applies to you. We learned this last week, that the way that your Mac charges its battery and manages its power is changing with the next version of the next like point update to Mac OS, right? What's going mm-hmm. on there?
So 10.15.5, they're going to add a new setting, which will be on by default, which is similar to the optimized battery charging thing they added in iOS 13 for iPhones and iPads. And so what optimized battery charging does is it uses like machine learning and analysis to see and predict your patterns of charging throughout the day. So it looks to see if you have a regular schedule where you always plug in at 8 p.m. and then you always wake up at 8 a.m. and disconnect it, it will only charge to 80% of the battery overnight. And then just before it expects you to take it off the charger, it will fill up to full. And that strategy is aiming to reduce the amount of time the battery sits on 100%, because lithium-ion batteries, which is what all these devices run on, optimally have the longest lifespan when you're leaving them on about the 70 to 80% battery range. And so leaving them plugged in full time does reduce how long your battery lasts for. Now, it doesn't reduce it to the degree that it's worth like babying your devices, right? Like it's probably like a, you know, 10 to 15% difference, but that is not enough for you to bother every single day. Okay, I'm going to plug it in and then I'm going to unplug it and then make sure it never goes to here. Like nobody can bother to do that. But if you actually think about it, you know, you're adding months onto the lifetime of the battery before it needs servicing. And so what they're doing now with 10.15.5 is a similar approach for macOS. So again, it will look at your routine. It will work out if your machine generally stays plugged in all day long, and then it will change how much it charges by. So right now, in, you know, the naive implementation, all your laptops just charge to 100% when you plug them in, and they just sit there on 100%. What will happen on this new system, which they just call battery health management in the settings, they don't call it optimized battery charging, which is a bit silly, I think, because it's very similar to what the iOS feature is, but they give it a slightly different name. If it notices that you're basically like a laptop as desktop user, like me, you know, 90% of the year, 95% of the year, my laptop's just sitting on my desk being plugged in and used. And it's rare. The rare case for me is when I'm using it portably, because I don't have an actual desktop. I just use my laptop as my, you know, as my desktop Mac, essentially. It will notice that and only charge the battery to 80% instead and sit on 80% rather than going to 100. Mm-hmm. So you're getting, so for me, like my laptop's in its suboptimal state for the majority of the year, because it's always sitting at my desk through the day. It's always at 100%. And ideally, it should stop at 80%. And I only need the extra, you know, 20% capacity when I'm actually doing traveling or mobile work, which is rare for me. But I'm not like an isolated case. There's loads of people who use their laptops in that way. And so this feature is aiming to help address that situation. And the one thing that is kind of annoying is that Apple's answer to, well, what if it predicts wrongly and you do actually want that 20% battery right now? Their answer is you have to go into settings or system preferences, you have to go into the battery menu, and then you have to turn off the battery health management option, and then it will charge to full. But that's not really what I want. Like, I only want it like temporarily, right? So what I'd prefer it to how it to work is if it's sitting on 80% and I know, okay, I'm actually going to go out now, so I want it to be charging to full in the next 20 minutes. I think I should just be able to like click on the battery icon in the menu bar and then say like charge to full and force it for just that one time to charge up to full. Mm-hmm. And then the next time you come and sit down and you recharge, it only goes back up to 80% again. Mm-hmm. Kind of like how low power mode works on iOS, where you can enable low power mode, but once your battery goes back up again, it turns it off for you. Because what's going to happen on 10.15.5 is it's like, okay, I need to get to 100%. I'll go into the settings. I'll dig through three levels of menu. I'll click the box to turn it off, press done. And then the next day I come back, sit down, and I've got to remember to go back into settings, go back into different preferences and turn it back on again, right, for the rest of the year. So they kind of need like a top level button that just lets you temporarily turn it off for the situations where you need it, rather than it being like, you know, you have to manually enable and disable it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep,
otherwise, I'm very happy because my battery definitely sits here on 100%, and I know it's not perfect. But you know, what am I going to do? I can't keep unplugging and replugging my laptop in constantly. I've just got to take it. Whereas now, I'm actually going to get the best lifespan for my battery possible.
Yeah, I use my MacBook in a way that I go from 100 to near zero at least every other day, and so I turned it off as soon as I went to the beta version, which I think is the right move for me. But yep. What about the 23-inch iMac? This has been kind of popular. This is a new rumor. How much do we know about a 23-inch iMac? what would it look like?
Well, we don't know what it'll look like.
You think it'll look like the 21.5-inch iMac?
I hope not.
Yeah, but like,
it's a report from China Times saying that Apple is planning a new 23-inch iMac this year alongside a new 11-inch iPad Air. There are not details provided about what the design change will be. Obviously, we've been talking about for a long time how the iMac is very dated. It has huge bezels. The overall chassis design hasn't changed since 2012. And then if you just look face on, so just the main forward, that design hasn't changed since 2010. because all they did in 2012 was make it slimmer at the edges on the sides. But the actual like fascia, the front plate, the same huge glass bezels, the same, you know, massive chin with the metal bit with the Apple logo in it. Like, compare it to any device, any other Apple device, the bezels are way are so much bigger. It's just like crazy. And so hopefully with this 23-inch one, what they've done is they've taken the 21.5-inch body and made the bezel smaller to fit a bigger screen in the same space. And hopefully it's not just, you know, what we have today, but with slightly more diagonal size. Like, I expect, honestly, more than just a bezel shrink. Like, at this point, I feel like the iMac's well has run its course of the current design, and it could do with a huge update that actually looks significantly different.
I'm with you. The iMac looks nice in the way that like the iPhone 4 looks nice. You know, it's dated, but it's nice.
Yeah, it's a classic design.
Yeah, it's just not.
But you don't. But like the you could say the iPhone SE is a classic design, but nobody wants the forehead and bezel chins. You know, the forehead and chin bezels. Right. Like, it's old and it's not very nice.
Yeah, and they offer
when Apple did the 2019 iMac processor update, they did interviews with press and stuff, and the woman who like runs the iMac team, you know, obviously they're just repeating what they've been, you know, trained to do with the press department, but she was like saying, and forgive me, I can't remember her name at this point, but she was saying stuff like, people love the iMac, they put it on their desk in offices and they let it like shine, and people use it as like a statement of, here it is, and it's sitting, you know, in full view, not hidden away in a computer room. And it's like, yeah, but the thing they're showing off could look a hell of a lot prettier. Doesn't look very nice. Like,
the thing that
I've got a 2010 iMac behind me, which looks identical to the modern ones face on, and it does not look very modern. Mm. And if you actually look in the innards, Apple continues to sell spinning hard drive iMacs. They continue to sell Fusion Drive iMacs, and the SSD options that they do have do not even have T2 chips inside them.
Yeah, that's the thing I care the most about with this update. You know, and we'll hear more. Like, if Ming-Chi Kuo has a report about this, then we'll probably know more about what happens here. You know, looks wise, screen resolution, for example.
And Bloomberg has said there's a new iMac coming as well. But again, I think Mark said it is redesigned, but you know, no details beyond.
Yeah, and redesign can mean bigger, as we've seen in the past. I would think that a new design, like we saw with, the first Retina MacBook, is that it came to, and maybe even the first Retina iMac, is that it was the iMac, it was the higher end model first, the larger screen higher end model, and then it came to the smaller one. So it'd be interesting to see the lower priced iMac have a newer design before the 27 inch does, or it could be that the 21.5 inch goes to 23, 27 has a new design as well, but it's still 27. You know, it's just smaller overall.
Which is what they did with the iPad Pros, remember?
Yeah.
They shifted the 10.5-inch iPad Pro to 11, but they kept the 12.9-inch at 12.9.
That's right. And we did see, you know, so LG has sold these displays for Apple, through Apple, the ultra-fine displays, which are effectively the same panel as what you get in the iMac, a 21.5-inch 4K monitor and a 27-inch 5K monitor. Minus the casing, which, you know, as much as you can dislike the iMac design for being gated, then LG can make it worse. So we know that much. But they,
at least the iMac's made of metal.
Yeah, not plastic. So they replaced the 21.5-inch version of their monitor with
a 23.5-inch.
20.
But it's 4K.
Yeah, they made it bigger, but not, I guess you sit further back to make it the sharp. So I was curious if that's a clue of what will happen with, I think they call it 24 inches, don't they? Maybe 23.5. But anyway, I wonder if that's a clue of what will happen with the iMac, because, you know, suppliers and
if there's... Yeah. And when you normally say like, I'm expecting the design to look different, and that's a huge open question. Like, there's people who are like, you know, you're just saying it needs to look different for the sake of it. But like, I'm not asking for it to be some crazy thing that no human's ever thought of before. Just take an iPad Pro and make the screen bigger, and you can take the touch out of it and just have that bit be the screen section, which, if you think about it, looks very similar to the Microsoft Surface Studio, which does have a touch screen and even does the thing where you can pull the stand down so you get like an easel on your desk, right? So pretty cool innovations. And that product came out 2017, 2016. So we're already like 4 years on from that time frame, and the iMac still looks the same.
Yeah.
Like I'm not asking for a miracle here. Just shrink the bezels down a lot, and then it'll look way more modern and way more current.
Yeah. I think I've got to say, though, that it's because of the popularity of, you know, MacBooks that you know, we used to see more design changes with the iMac when the iMac was like the thing. But it's surely a small percentage of their Mac sales, you know, and so it's,
yeah. And this design ran its course well, right? Like,
sure, yeah.
they had it in 2010, and then they slimmed the sides in 2012, and that ran them through easily, comfortably through the next like 3 or 4 years. And then around the time that the iPhone 10 came out, which was late 2017, all of Apple's products that had, you know, massive bezels and chunky chins started to look out of place. And it's now 3 years on since the iPhone 10 came out, and we've seen no traction on the iMac improving, either in physical design or internally with stuff like the T2 chip and the SSD support. So it's, you know, it definitely feels like it's a stagnating product line. And so I'm very much looking forward to the redesign that will make it look incredible.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and then, because like imagine the iPad Pro on the smart keyboard, like the Magic Keyboard, that's just come out. Like if the iPad Pro screen was huge, that almost looked like a modern iMac, right? Like,
yes.
With a cool little like floating design. They can call it floating, or they can do whatever they want with it. But just, you know, it needs to look different from the 2012 model, which is now 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Bloomberg, Mark Gurman has a new timeline on Mac switching to ARM, or the first Mac that runs on an ARM processor instead of an Intel processor. So what's different in this report?
Yeah, so back in 2018, Mark said that Apple was targeting the first ARM Mac for late 2020. Since then, you know, we've heard a few people like saying late 2020, early 2021. This week, Gurman re-upped his reporting to say it's coming in 2021. But he did have some cool details that it's going to be a entry-level laptop, and it will have a 12-core processor, which will run on the 5-nanometer fabrication, which will first be seen with the A14 chip in this year's iPhones and iPads, right?
Wow.
Or at least the iPhones, because we've heard that the iPad update is delayed to next year. So the A14 chip's coming out this year in the phone, running on TSMC's new 5-nanometer fabrication, and Apple has been working on, according to Mark, a team that's basically, they've synchronized chip development. So the architecture of the A14 will also be shared with the new Mac chip, right? So it won't be the same chip, but like the same process and the same rough ideas of going into the chips will be shared across both. And they've already started work on the 2021 Mac chips as well, which are again sharing like the development of the 2021 iPhone chips. So they're kind of in lockstep, right? But obviously, when you get to the details of like cores and process speeds, that depends on the actual form factor of the device it's going into.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mark says that the first ARM Mac from Apple will be a laptop, and it will have a 12-core chip, which will feature 8 performance cores and 4 high-efficiency cores. And the current iPad Pro is an 8-core design where 6 of them are high performance and 2 of them are low power, I believe. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a boost up from even what the iPad Pro performance is today in a laptop form factor. And obviously that comes with all the benefits of what we expect from ARM too. So if you look at the Intel line, the entry-level MacBook Air is a dual-core processor. So you're going from 2 to 12, right? And regardless of what they clocked out, the 12 is always going to be in the dust.
Yeah.
Plus, we expect that the efficiency of those chips will also be very, very high. So you'll probably get the same battery life, if not substantially better battery life, for the same thickness and battery size. So it's basically going to be a win all round with a high performance entry level laptop. And then Apple has ambitions to follow up and slowly start to address the higher end, MacBook Pros and eventually the desktop workstations as well. Gurman says that Apple doesn't yet have ARM chips that are capable or of competing with the, you know, high end MacBook Pro performance. So don't expect like the top end MacBook Pros to be switching to ARM within the year, right? But it's not because they're not interested in it. It's just they're starting first by prioritizing the MacBook Air equivalent products, right? And then maybe the 13-inch MacBook Pro will also get updated in that way. And frankly, that's Apple's best-selling computers as well, so it makes sense that they're starting in that direction.
Yeah, yeah. I can see this thing costing more than the MacBook Air, especially now that the Air's come down. Like being more like the 12-month MacBook price, regardless of like whatever size it is.
Yeah, they could re-innovate the 12-inch MacBook playbook.
Yes.
Just with a much... Because the biggest criticism against the 12-inch MacBook was it was slow, right? It was
slow, $1,300. And yeah, yeah. And then this, yeah, it wasn't a good value at least. I liked it.
But
it
yeah. And so if they could bring that back, but running on, you know, Apple's ARM chip instead... Theoretically, they could sell it for cheaper because they're not having to pay Intel licensing fees. Obviously, Apple
but they can make more money if they don't. Yeah,
yeah, they can. Yeah, so maybe it will start with like a new quote unquote new entry into the lineup, like a new 12-inch MacBook. Mm-hmm. But clearly, eventually, it will also be what's powering the MacBook Airs as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I can imagine, you know, this being the first Mac with LTE or 5G or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Because they're using their ARM chip, and so that would be neat to see.
And Gurman says they are exploring quote unquote tools to make non updated apps work on the ARM platform, so mm-hmm. essentially emulation. There's a big question mark at the moment about is Apple going to bother with emulation at all? Are they going to do it in some limited form? It's not clear whether they're even going to bother with it, because like if you're starting with the entry level computers,
yeah.
They're the ones where, you know, high end app support doesn't really matter, right? And paradoxically, if you do want to make the high end apps work before the developers get around to updating them, we're thinking primarily about like Adobe here. The emulation is so slow and so performance intensive that you wouldn't want to use the high-end apps in emulation anyway. So there's a question about whether Apple's going to offer it at all. Maybe they are going to, maybe we don't. Gurman says they're exploring their options, but it doesn't sound like they've like made a decision yet.
Mm-hmm.
When they did the previous Mac CPU architecture transition from PowerPC to Intel, they did offer emulation. And, you know, it works, but you're getting like a third of the overall potential performance of the machine. And back in 2005, Apple didn't have the money, the resources, they didn't have the financial patience to be able to release computers that didn't support the entire ecosystem of Mac software, right? Whereas today, they very much could do that and have it as a like a secondary line of machine, kind of like what the 12-inch MacBook was, right? Where, you know, when you're buying the 12-inch MacBook, you can't commit to not run Photoshop and stuff on it just because of its performance profile, its characteristics. And so you could get another repeat of that there. And them not supporting emulation would be a case for them introducing it and not calling it MacBook Air, mm-hmm. right, for the time being. And then if you run the new product line for a year, in that year time frame, maybe that gives time for the developers to update their apps anyway and be native to ARM. And like, because that's the other thing about offering emulation. When you offer an emulation option, it then makes all developers more lazy, right? Because it's like, yeah. The apps are working. I don't have to bother. Whereas if Apple didn't offer any emulation at all, then there's more of a motivation for these people to come on board and actually invest resources mm-hmm. into it, which is exactly the playbook they did with like 64-bit apps, right? Where the current macOS operating system doesn't support 32-bit apps at all. And so by giving the hard deadline, it pushed the stragglers, including Adobe, to get on board and actually adopt 64-bit universally. But if they hadn't have done that, and if they still offered some way to run 32-bit apps this year, you just know the number of apps that that migrated would be lower. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just a reality.
Yeah.
And I think they could get away with it. I really think they could release a new entry-level MacBook that is super fast, super light, battery life is fantastic. And then the trade-off is, well, you're only running Safari and all the Apple apps and all the App Store apps that do update, and maybe the Catalyst apps because they're, you know, modern. And like, are people going to care that they can't run Lightroom or Photoshop or Avid or, you know, those higher end apps? They kind of fade into irrelevance for a product of that size. And you can bring that product out, you can introduce that product to the market, and then it gives some time for the developers to be like, okay, Apple's actually doing this ARM stuff now. We'll get on board and we'll start releasing compatibility updates and moving ahead.
Yeah, like, you've got me convinced that they won't do emulation. If they did, it would be so bad. It'd be like on an iPhone app running on the iPad, where
like, and the proposition for doing this on Mac is like, it's a, you know, they want to stand on the stage. They're going to say, look, we're just so good. We made this incredible chip. Our engineering and silicon teams are so good. This thing, it's 5 nanometers. It's got 12 cores. Look how much faster it is. Like, they're not, that story is so incompatible with, well, you can run your old apps in emulation, but they're going to be like 25% as performant. Like, it doesn't really add up.
Right.
So I'd be surprised if they did that. Like, emulation is a possibility for like a desktop computer, I think, because you don't quite have the same like battery constraints and stuff. Like, so you can just run your chips at full power and make up the difference. But if you're going for like thin and light laptops, I feel like, you know, if you can do emulation, we might as well just carry on selling Intel laptops. So if you're going to forge a new path ahead, in my opinion, I feel like they have to leave the legacy behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Catalyst, there's a new update for Twitter for the Mac this week, and it adds streaming for tweets, which is a big deal for people like you and me who missed the classic Twitter API that supported streaming in apps like Tweetbot.
The good old days.
Yeah, where you can just have Tweetbot for Mac open, and as soon as a new tweet is sent out into the world and you follow it, it shows up on your screen. No, you know, interaction required. Pretty essential for following breaking news and what we do. So, you know, since then we've had to use Tweetbot for that, and it's a web app.
TweetDeck, you mean?
TweetDeck for that. It's a web app, yeah. And, you know, it's gotten better. It used to be really bad. Now it's just you know, it's the worst thing.
That it's like borderline acceptable.
Yeah, the worst thing about it is that it's a web app, not that it's just terrible all around. So I tried, and so I've grown to love TweetDeck for what it is and take advantage of things that it can do that you don't get from the Twitter app or even Tweetbot. So, but this week when I saw that Twitter for Mac got streaming, they call it like pen to top or something like that. Like, it's vague, but it's what I call streaming. And, you know, your timeline refreshes as tweets are entered into it. It makes perfect sense. I tested it thinking, do I really want to switch to this and give up some of the TweetDeck features or benefits of it? Not only features, but just, benefits of it that I've grown accustomed to. I thought, well, yeah, I'll get used to whatever and I can adapt to it and it'll work out. And so what I did was I had my timeline in TweetDeck and my timeline in the new Twitter for Mac app with streaming turned on. And I just watched as new tweets came in, and it wasn't apples to apples. It was not – the Twitter for Mac app was – I wouldn't use it for this purpose. Like, you know, I actually turned the feature back off just so when I have it open, it won't update.
It was just too slow.
It missed tweets. Like, chunks of tweets just weren't there. So it's not like a serious – you know, if you want to see your timeline as you're watching it, you know, go by. It's
not a fire hose.
It's not a fire hose. No, it's like a sprinkler.
That is kind of crappy.
Yeah. I couldn't even like complain about like animations and things like that. Like, that's how we used to look at Tweetbot versus Twitter before was how it would stream. And it was like the old Twitter app, you know, it would stream, but it was janky or jarring. And, yep. You know, Tweetbot was smoother. Well, this was just literally you weren't getting all the information that you were seeking. And our colleague Chance was using it, and he didn't do the side-by-side comparison. So he didn't realize. It's like it looks like it's fine. You don't know what you're not seeing. And so I challenged him to look at TweetDeck in comparison. And sure enough, he was missing chunks of tweets. Like every 5 seconds, some number of tweets would be missing. So it's
I wonder if that's a bug.
I don't know.
Yeah. It seems a bit pointless of a feature to stream, but I mean, you only get like a third of what's coming in.
Yeah, if you follow like, you know, a small number of accounts, then I guess it's not really an issue if they're not that high volume, I guess. But, you know, it wasn't what I was looking for. And then of course, you know, going over to the iPad, they don't support it on the iPad, even though it's the Mac Catalyst app, you know, of the iPad. It's only on the Mac for now. But I use TweetDeck on the browser on the iPad. So
yeah, because I would never pick to use, because I tried Twitter for Mac when it first came out, and it's a classic Catalyst experience, right? Where it's like,
I mean, there's cool things like you know, I guess Command N to make a new tweet, and like it's got your, it's better at picking a recent image to send in a message or tweet than the messages app. So in the messages app, you drag and drop a photo to send the photo, or you send it like from an extension.
Yeah.
In Twitter, it sees your recent pictures from photos, just like, you know, setting your wallpaper or something would, or your user account. But on messages, it's not. Twitter does. So it's like, it's got some nice things about it, you know, but it's, if you're missing chunks of tweets, it's no good. So.
Yeah, streaming's number one. Like, TweetDeck could be 10 times worse, and I still use it as long as it's streaming.
I mean, it used to be 10 times worse, and we had to use it, so.
Yeah, and now it's only, like, half as worse. But it's still... Like, every time I use TweetDeck, I'm like, I wish this was a native app. It'd be so much nicer, because you can't even make, like, two windows of TweetDeck. It's stupid. But it streams, and that's ultimately what's most important for us.
Yeah. My biggest TweetDeck complaint right now is that on the touch bar, if you have a notifications turned on with sound, the TweetDeck sound will take over as the now playing, you know, program on your touch bar. And so you'll see it animate across, like, in 2 seconds, like, bird sound, whatever, you know, and it like plays across your touch bar. But what that also means is that it's like stuck in TweetDeck as your media player, even if you're also playing a podcast or music. And so I just turned off sound for all notifications for TweetDeck, you know, which is probably better anyway. But
what Twitter app are you using on your phone these days?
I use the Twitter app on the iPhone and the iPad for like catching up and kind of browsing. But if I'm doing work stuff, then I'm looking at TweetDeck on the web.
Just not really on the
phone, you know, for that purpose. But
I'm thinking like more about so on the phone experience, you switch to Twitter. I love Tweetbot. It was really nice, but as soon as the API started like punishing them, mm-hmm. and they couldn't access the activity feed with the nice mentions and mm-hmm. the streamlined yep. notification stuff, and then they had to turn off streaming as well on their app, like that engagement feed. Vanity feed, whatever you want to call it, like it's just so useful to just see everything that's happening, see the likes, see the replies. And as soon as TweetDeck couldn't offer that anymore, I was like, well, I guess I'm gonna have to switch to the Twitter app, and that's what I've been doing. And I still prefer the UI of Tweetbot, but just, you know, Jack Dorsey keeps talking about how they're being more accepting of developers, but they're not putting the key features back into the API that actually make the third-party apps any good.
Yeah, I haven't looked at one of the Tweetbot apps or any of the other third-party apps in so long. I wouldn't know. I think it'd feel foreign at this point. But and there's things that I do on the Twitter app, like I receive notifications from certain tweets, you know, as they come out, and mm-hmm. You know, things like that. But yeah, I haven't even thought about third-party apps since they broke them, basically.
So. It's sad, because they used to be, like, a defining point of the iPhone, I'd say. Like, the iPhone had incredibly good third-party Twitter apps, and the Android side was kind of, like, looking on in sadness, but Twitter screwed it all up.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, that was my Twitter for Mac review was... and one more thing that's just happened in the last few weeks on Twitter for Mac is, you know, with the touch bar... They added initial touch bar support, and it was like very limited. It was
like two buttons.
Yeah, it was like two buttons. They've enhanced it to, it's pretty good, but I find that what I often want is on the touch bar when I'm in a composed tweet mode is to see emoji. and I don't think you can without like using the old classic like command control option command space bar thing to like make it pop up. I think it overrides like the whole thing, like when you're in a text field. I think it just keeps showing the sidebar buttons and compose, things like that. So not a perfect app.
Sigh.
Yeah. That's okay. I like TweetDeck. TweetDeck's gotten better. So I'm a professional now, I guess. So
they should I mean, they're not going to, because I guess TweetDeck's mostly used by like social media managers and stuff.
Yeah.
But it'd be really nice if they could do like a Catalyst tweet deck that you could also run on the iPad.
That would be cool. I would be down for that. Yep. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. We will be back next week with a new episode. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. You can also send us a message. I'm on Twitter and Instagram @ApolloZach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter @BZAMayo. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.